It's now my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Senator Jeff Flake. To many in this room, he'll need very little introduction. He comes from Snowflake, Arizona, a town founded by his great-great-grandfather, and he has had a distinguished career in public service. We're proud to claim him as a graduate of Brigham Young University, and we're also always appreciative when he makes his way back home. Senator Flake serves on the Judiciary Committee, which, as a lawyer, is this professional bias, Gordon, is among the most important committees in the U.S. Senate. The work they do there, some of it high profile, much of it less high profile, matters immensely to the future of our country and to the future of religious freedom in the United States. He has had a distinguished career. One of the things that I am really impressed with is early in his career, he went to Namibia and worked for the Endowment of Democracy and helped establish a strong and thriving democracy in that beautiful African country. Our center helped organize a African conference in Namibia a few years ago, and it is a bastion of stability in a neighborhood which is not altogether stable. He also returned then to Arizona, where he was the head of the Goldwater Institute, where he served the legacy of Senator Barry Goldwater and also worked to develop conservative principles. He reminded me this morning that he is often referred to as that other senator from Arizona. I think that's a pretty good label to be known as, but for us today, he's our friend and someone we admire deeply. And we're grateful for his being here to talk with us this morning. Please join me in welcoming Senator Jeff Flake.
Well, thank you, Brett. It's great to be here. I appreciate this invitation. And I want to thank the Center for Law and Religion Studies for inviting me and for organizing this conference. I know it's a lot of hard work that's gone into it. Now, being back on this campus obviously brings a lot of great memories. My wife Cheryl and I actually first met on Temple Beach in Laie on Oahu's North Shore. We dated while at BYU Hawaii. Cheryl dumped me while at BYU Hawaii. So it was here on this campus in the Wilkinson Center at a dance that our friendship and then romance was rekindled. This is where I learned to grovel. We had classes together at the Swicket. We flirted at the Harold B. Lee Library when we should have been studying. Those were the days. I have no such fond memories of the testing center. Nothing good ever happened at the testing center. But as an aside, Cheryl still shakes her head when she sees me speaking at any event like this. 7 years after we met in Hawaii, after we'd been married and two kids later, we traveled back to Hawaii and went to that exact spot where we met on the beach, reminisced. Then we drove up to the school. And for those who have been there, it's just a short trip from the beach. But as we were driving to the school, I thought this changed quite a bit. I said, Cheryl, that's a new building there on the right. She said, no, that was here when we were. That's the library. It was new to me. So that's why she's surprised when she sees me doing this kind of thing. But on to today's topic. Efforts to protect religious freedom continue to be at the forefront of the national debate. The next several days will provide you an opportunity to look backward over the past year and think about what's to come in the year ahead. Now, this conference continues to be relevant, timely, and important. That's why I'm so pleased to be here. Let me just say that June was quite a month for my family and me. I was at the baseball practice the morning of the tragic shooting. It left 5 seriously injured, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. who still faces a long road to recovery. When I arrived back at the Capitol that morning and changed out of my baseball uniform, the red stains on my uniform and my blood-soaked batting glove were reminders of how fortunate I had been. Most people will look out at a ball field like that and take pity on a bunch of middle-aged men trying to relive their childhood. One man looked out on the ball field and saw the enemy. We may never know why or how. And then just last week, my father's long and wonderful life came to a peaceful end in Snowflake. We marked his passing with a wonderful celebration of the man he was and the legacy he left behind. I mention these events only to make the point that in both feast and famine, I am reassured by the peace and comfort provided by my faith. It has always been so. Every event of significance in my life draws meaning because of my faith, my beliefs, my religion. That's why I so strongly support religious liberty and believe that the rights recognized by the First Amendment are so fundamental. The Constitution reflects the nation's ideals and values. When many settlers in America, having fled religious persecution, the founders understood that the protection of religious freedom was essential. It was essential then, it is essential now. For me, this is not a theoretical or esoteric issue. I'm grateful to live in a country where I can exercise that faith freely and believe that no one should be forced by their government to violate their deeply held religious belief. When I think about this past year, certainly the high point for religious liberty was the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch as Associate Justice to the Supreme Court. I give credit to the President and his team for nominating Judge Gorsuch and to Senator McConnell for ensuring that we had the opportunity to move him through the Senate. When I had the privilege of meeting with Judge Gorsuch early in his confirmation process, I asked him about his thoughts on religious freedom. I was struck by his ability to plainly articulate his understanding of the law and our Constitution. As an appellate judge, his record on religious liberty cases was second to none. In fact, this was a fact that I continually extolled on the Senate floor and referenced during his confirmation hearing. He explained his religious liberty opinions by telling me that he simply, quote, went where the law led him. He left me with a distinct impression that he reads the Constitution as the framers understood it and tries to implement laws the way they were written. I was pleased to have a chance to sit on the Judiciary Committee and offer my early support as well as join my colleagues in voting for his confirmation on the Senate floor. Thus far, Judge Gorsuch is proving to be the champion of religious liberty that I thought he would be. Just last week, Judge Gorsuch sided with Chief Justice Roberts and a majority of the justices when he concluded that Missouri couldn't discriminate against the Lutheran Church, in providing recycled tire material to a playground just because it was owned by a church. Justice Gorsuch wrote separately, however, to explain that this just wasn't a case about playgrounds. He said, quote, "The general principles here do not permit discrimination against any religious exercise, whether on the playground or anywhere else." He also explained eloquently that religious liberty isn't just about religious belief, it is about living out your life as a believer. He said that the Constitution protects, quote, "the free exercise of religion, not just the right to inward belief." Now, looking toward next year, the court announced that it will hear the case of the Colorado Bakery, and I'm sure we will continue to hear from the court on the issue of religious freedom well into the future. As the administration continues to fill judicial vacancies, even potential additional Supreme Court vacancies, I hope that the courts will be an increasingly favorable venue for religious protections. However, this process will take time, and the courts will remain a gamble. And while I hate to admit it, given the political environment, measurable achievements in Congress will also remain an iffy proposition. We saw this last year with the trials and tribulations of getting signed into law even the most non-controversial provision aimed at ensuring religious-run institutions a fair shot at competing for federal contracts. Out of practical reality, and for better or worse, the states will continue to be an important focus and forum when it comes to progress on religious freedom protections. While certainly states can overreach as easily as can the federal government, they can also provide opportunities born out of trust and familiarity that can lead to meaningful compromise. For example, these relationships were certainly a contributing factor to the state of Utah's success in crafting the Utah Compromise. Far from having all the answers, I continue to believe that harmony is possible between the protection of fundamental rights, which we all possess, religious or otherwise, and the safeguarding of rights of churches and religious institutions to practice their faith freely. Now, our commitment to religious freedom has received a recent test. During the last presidential campaign in December of 2015, when one candidate proposed a ban on all Muslims entering the country, a chorus of elected officials, religious leaders, and commentators denounced the proposal as contrary to our Constitution, our ideals, our tradition, and our practice. When I first heard the proposal, my family and I, later that week, attended afternoon prayers at the Islamic Center for the Northeast Valley in Scottsdale to let the congregation know that most Americans were not given to such intolerance. I was asked to speak. "I'll bet you never thought you'd see a Mormon speaking in a mosque," I began my talk. I said, "I think it is a surprise for me too. We all know that we are different, but let me tell you a few ways where we are similar." I then recounted some of the challenges faced by Mormons in Missouri as our young country struggled to live up to its ideals of religious freedom. The concept of employing a religious test for immigrants would hit particularly close to our family less than a year later. On November 3rd of 2016, my wife's father, Owen Bay, played two softball games, manning his usual position on the pitcher's mound. But while he was reading the newspaper the following morning, he had a stabbing pain causing him to collapse on the floor. He was barely able to tell his wife, Joyce, "I'm having a heart attack." An ambulance was called and Owen was taken to Mercy Gilbert Hospital, where he had a preliminary test done. In very critical condition, he was transferred to a nearby hospital where an experienced cardiologist could tend to him. That evening, a doctor named Fadi Khoury sat us down and informed us that Owen's aorta had ruptured. The rupture had somehow cauterized itself, temporarily at least, which is why Owen was still alive. However, Dr. Khoury explained, the mortality rate after such an event increased by 2% per hour, meaning that Owen would not likely survive another 48 hours without surgery to repair the damage. Now, my father-in-law was 83 years old. Surgery would be extremely risky, but it was the only hope. A six-hour procedure was expected, but the lining of the aorta chamber kept failing. So 6 hours turned into 11 hours, and after all of their efforts, Owen's heart wouldn't start. It simply refused to beat. The rupture had been too violent, the injury too grievous. Cheryl's father had survived the emergency, we thought, now only to die in intensive care. Now, the bypass machine at Chandler Hospital was not designed to keep a patient alive for longer than 11 hours. And so when Dr. Khoury emerged from the operating room to brief us, he said, "We'll give it one more shot in an hour," but added that if Owen's heart didn't start at that point, there's probably nothing else that could be done. An hour later, his heart still would not start, but Dr. Khoury had one last idea. It was then that he called another doctor, this one named Jama Jahanier, who arrived from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale with a machine to keep Owen's body functioning for a longer period, giving his heart a better chance to recover. Even so, we had no idea if his heart would ever beat on its own again. Dr. Jahangir would not give up, leading a team of several doctors and nurses, performing several surgeries over the ensuing weeks to keep Owen alive as his heart healed. Each of these doctors vested themselves in Owen's care, and each refused to let him die without first exhausting himself of every last option. Both Dr. Corey and Dr. Jahangir are now family to us. They certainly could have thought, he's lived a long life, this is where it should end. Instead, they stayed up all night, they postponed family vacations, and they fulfilled their obligations to a patient and his family in a most extraordinary way. I should mention that Owen played a round of golf last week. But Fadi Corey had not always been a brilliant cardiothoracic surgeon. He had once been a Palestinian boy growing up amid unceasing violence and limited prospects. Jama Jahangir had not always been a brilliant surgeon either. He was born in Afghanistan, a destroyed country, similarly roiled by decades of war. The stories of these two doctors are the stories of America, of striving, sometimes desperately, for a better life, of being willing to do anything and risk everything to get here. These are the stories of constant renewal by wave after wave of immigrants, creating our country over and over again. Stories that have made America unique in the history of the world. Neither of these men started out life as high-value migrants. Neither would likely have become who they are had they not made it to America. And neither might have been allowed into America if we had employed a religious test or if we had restricted visas from majority Muslim countries compromised by terrorism. We must stand for religious freedom in this country, regardless of the prevailing political winds. I also believe that our efforts to protect freedom of religion and religious liberty should not end at our borders. As mentioned, I've had the privilege of serving on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for years now, and have been working to lift the embargo and end the travel ban to Cuba. I've always believed, it's a crazy thought, but if we really wanted to punish the Castro brothers, we should just make them deal with spring break once or twice. That ought to do it. But for nearly 40 years after Cuba's revolution, those who professed religious beliefs, or so-called believers, were not allowed to hold government jobs. Of course, in a communist society, there are no jobs outside of government. Thus, to be a believer in Cuba was a monumental sacrifice. Now, following the Pope's visit in 1998, there has been a gradual thaw in religious persecution in Cuba. When I first traveled to the island, along with Cheryl 15 years ago, there's a small LDS community comprised mainly of expatriates, and these members were under considerable scrutiny from the government. While there is ostensibly freedom to worship in Cuba, the relationship between religious institutions and the Castro regime is very complex, and there are strict limitations on religious activity. Now, through humanitarian work, the LDS Church began building relationships through the front door that fostered an environment for a small branch in Havana to grow. Eventually, another branch was established in Cotoro, and both branches have seen considerable growth over the past few years. Just this week, I received an email from Pedro Ramos, a faithful member in Cotoro, informing me as follows in broken English, quote, "We have a new district in Cuba, and I am called as president. There are Mormons in 6 provinces. We have baptism every week. For example, next Saturday, we will have 3 baptisms. There are also 20 Cuban missionaries." By this, I believe he's referring to what we call ward missionaries. He said, "They are old people, no youngs." I think they're not old, but middle-aged maybe at least. Now, as a testament to the faith of the believers who have endured so much hardship over the years, there are now well over 100 members of the LDS Church on the island, and Cuba's first full-time missionary from the Cortoro branch has been serving for about 18 months here in Utah. Now, my colleagues and I in the U.S. Senate have sought to support the easing of religious restrictions on the island of Cuba by building relationships not just with the LDS Church, but with the dominant Catholic Church and the Cuban Council of Churches. I'm convinced that the recent progress toward normalized relations between the United States and Cuba owes much to the spiritual yearnings of believers, people like Cardinal Ortega of the Catholic Church. In December of 2014, I was quietly asked by the Obama administration if I would play a role in a Cold War era spy swap with Cuba, much of which was orchestrated by Cardinal Ortega. Unbeknownst to any of our colleagues, in the early morning hours of December 17th, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy and I took off from Andrews Air Force Base on one of the president's planes headed toward Cuba. Our job was to pick up Alan Gross, an American who had been charged as a spy and had spent 5 years in a Cuban prison after being caught distributing computer equipment to the Cuban Jewish community. While we were flying toward Cuba, two more planes took off. One was to pick up a CIA asset, a Cuban national who had spent 20 years in prison in Cuba. And another plane was to take three Cuban spies who had spent the past year in U.S. prisons back to the island. We landed at three separate airfields in and around Havana. We had to offload and unload our human cargo. And after a brief meeting that I had with Cuba's foreign minister, we were back on the tarmac waiting for the signal to be in the air again. Exactly 31 minutes after we'd landed, we were back on our plane headed toward the United States with Alan Gross on board. 25 minutes into the flight, the pilot announced, "We have entered U.S. airspace." I'll never forget what happened next. Alan Gross stood and pumped his fists in celebration, breathing deeply in and out several times, declaring, "Now I know I'm free." Now, after landing, Presidents Obama and Castro jointly announced in separate capitals that the United States and Cuba would, after more than half a century, resume diplomatic relations. The following day, I received a call from President Obama to discuss the path forward for the governments of the United States and Cuba. Exactly 2 minutes later, I received a call from Elder Jeffrey R. Holland to discuss new possibilities for the LDS Church in Cuba. While considerable progress on religious freedom has been made in Cuba, there's much more to do. The LDS Church continues to lack official recognition by the Cuban government, complicating property ownership, and proselyting and traditional missionary work is still not permitted. But while our efforts to expand religious freedom in Cuba have been an exercise in relationship building and more of a carrot approach, we recently had to employ a slightly different approach when it came to Botswana. A few years ago, Botswanan authorities adopted a blanket prohibition on visas for U.S. missionaries. After extensive diplomacy and dialogue failed to produce an acceptable outcome, we took steps to highlight the benefits of a vibrant relationship with the U.S. and to explain the downside of unilateral action to deny visas. We had an amendment adopted during consideration of the International Religious Freedom Act reauthorization last year to expand reporting of the State Department's International Religious Freedom Report to include routine denial of religious visas. The amendment expressed the sense of Congress that routine denial of religious visas is indicative of a lack of religious freedom. Now, through these means, combined with a bit of scrutiny on U.S. visas being issued to Botswanan authorities, we emphasize the potential downside for needless restrictions on religious freedoms for U.S. religious institutions. Finally, the Botswanan government has once again found a way to accept LDS missionaries into the country on renewable temporary visas. The first American missionaries re-entered Zimbabwe after almost 4 years of absence just last month. Now, protecting religious freedom worldwide is particularly near and dear to me. As a young man, I served my Mormon mission in Southern Africa, serving in South Africa and Zimbabwe. And as was mentioned, Cheryl and I spent a year in the country of Namibia, which for a political junkie, that was nirvana. To be there when a country writes its constitution, has its first elections, it was a wonderful time. Today, our son Tanner is serving his mission in Southern Africa as well, in the Botswana Namibia mission. My wife Cheryl and I could not be more proud. John Adams once said, "Freedom of thought and of the right of private judgment in matters of conscience direct their course to this happy country as their last asylum." I'm sure that we all share the hope that our inherent rights to religious freedom continue to be recognized in the United States for generations to come. I'm sure we also share the hope that such freedoms one day need not look to the United States for their last asylum, but can be exercised in countries around the globe. Conferences like these move us toward those goals. I wish you the best in the coming days, and thank you for inviting me here. Enjoy the conference.